content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's Halaf. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. And speaking of chuckles, today's show is all about the chuckles, by way of philosophy and jokes. Not two things you figured would go together, huh? From the book Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes, written by Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein, and published in 2007, we'll hear several excerpts on philosophical ideas and the jokes that illuminate them. First, a few words from the authors. Philogagging, an introduction. Dimitri, if Atlas holds up the world, what holds up Atlas? Tasso, Atlas stands on the back of a turtle. Dimitri, but what does the turtle stand on? Tasso, another turtle. Dimitri, and what does that turtle stand on? Tasso, my dear Dimitri, it's turtles all the way down. This bit of ancient Greek dialogue perfectly illustrates the philosophical notion of infinite regress, a concept that comes up when we ask if there is a first cause of life, of the universe, of time and space, and, most significantly, of a creator. Something must have created the creator, so the causal buck, or turtle, cannot stop with him, or with the creator behind him, or the one behind him. It's creators all the way down, or up, if that seems like the right direction for chasing down creators. If you find that infinite regress is getting you nowhere fast, you might consider the doctrine of creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. Or, as John Lennon put it in a slightly different context, before Elvis, there was nothing. But let's lend an ear to old Tasso again. As well as being illuminating, his rejoinder, "It's turtles all the way down," definitely has the ring of a punchline. Bada-bing! That's no surprise to us. The construction and payoff of jokes and the construction and payoff of philosophical concepts are made out of the same stuff. They tease the mind in similar ways. That's because philosophy and jokes proceed from the same impulse to confound our sense of the way things are, to flip our worlds upside down, and to ferret out hidden, often uncomfortable, truths about life. What the philosopher calls an insight, the gagster calls a zinger. For example, consider the following classic joke. On the surface, it just sounds deliciously goofy, but on closer inspection, it speaks to the very heart of British empiricist philosophy, the question of what sort of information about the world we can depend on. Morty comes home to find his wife and his best friend, Lou, naked together in bed. Just as Morty is about to open his mouth, Lou jumps out of the bed and says, "Before you say anything, old pal, what are you going to believe, me or your eyes?" By challenging the primacy of sensory experience, Lou raises the question of what sort of data is certain and why. Is one way of gathering facts about the world, say, seeing, more dependable than others, say, a leap of faith that accepts Lou's description of reality? Here's another example of a philogag, this one a riff on the argument from analogy, which says that if two outcomes are similar, they must have a similar cause. A 90-year-old man went to the doctor and said, "Doctor, my 18-year-old wife is expecting a baby." The doctor said, "Let me tell you a story. A man went hunting, but instead of a gun, he picked up an umbrella by mistake. When a bear suddenly charged at the man, he picked up the umbrella, shot the bear, and killed it." The man said, "Impossible. Someone else must have shot that bear." The doctor said, "My point exactly." You couldn't ask for a better illustration of the argument from analogy, a philosophical ploy currently, and erroneously, being used in the argument for intelligent design, i.e., if there's an eyeball, there must be an eyeball designer in the sky. We could go on, and in fact we will, from agnosticism to Zen, from hermeneutics to eternity. We will show how philosophical concepts can be illuminated by jokes, and how many jokes are loaded with fascinating philosophical content. Wait a second. Are those two notions the same? Can we get back to you on that? Students wandering into a philosophy class are usually hoping to gain some perspective on, say, the meaning of it all. But then some rumpled guy in mismatched tweeds ambles up to the podium and starts lecturing on the meaning of meaning. First things first, he says, before we answer any question, big or small, we need to understand what the question itself signifies. Listening reluctantly, we soon discover that what this guy has to say is wicked interesting. That's just the way philosophy and philosophers are. Questions beget questions, and those questions beget another whole generation of questions. It's questions all the way down. We may start with basic ones like, what is the meaning of it all? And does God exist? And how can I be true to myself? And am I in the wrong classroom? But very quickly, we discover we need to ask other questions in order to answer our original questions. This process has given rise to an array of philosophical disciplines, each delving into particular big questions by asking and attempting to answer the questions that underlie them. Any questions? So it follows that what is the meaning of it all is dealt with in the discipline known as metaphysics, and does God exist in the one called philosophy of religion. How can I be true to myself falls to the school of existentialism. Am I in the wrong classroom to the new sector of philosophy called metaphilosophy, which poses the question, what is philosophy? And on it goes, with each sphere of philosophy undertaking different kinds of questions and concepts. We've arranged this book not chronologically, but by those questions we had in mind when we wandered into that first philosophy classroom, and the philosophical disciplines that tackle them. What's so neat is that a whole bunch of jokes just happen to occupy the identical conceptual territory as these disciplines. Pure chance, or is there an intelligent designer after all? And there is a big reason why this is all so neat. When the two of us wandered out of that classroom, we were so baffled and bewildered, we were convinced we'd never get our minds around this heady stuff. That's when a graduate student sauntered up to us and told us the joke about Morty coming home to find his best friend, Lou, in bed with his wife. Now that's philosophy, he said. We call it philogagging. Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein, August 2006. Let's dive right into the big questions of philosophy, including purpose. Metaphysics. Metaphysics tackles the big questions head-on. What is being? What is the nature of reality? Do we have free will? How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? How many does it take to change a light bulb? Dimitri, something's been bothering me lately, Tasso. Tasso, what's that? Dimitri, what is the meaning of it all? Tasso, all what? Dimitri, you know, life, death, love, the whole stuffed grape leaf. Tasso, what makes you think any of it has any meaning? Dimitri, because it has to. Otherwise, life would just be... Tasso, what? Dimitri, I need an ouzo. Teleology. Does the universe have a purpose? According to Aristotle, everything has a telos, which is an inner goal it is meant to attain. An acorn has a telos, an oak tree. It's what an acorn is meant to be. Birds have one, bees have one. They say that down in Boston, even beans have one. It's part of the very structure of reality. If that seems a little abstract, in the following story, Mrs. Goldstein telescopes the telos down to earth. Mrs. Goldstein was walking down the street with her two grandchildren. A friend stopped to ask her how old they were. She replied, "The doctor is 5 and the lawyer is 7. Does human life have a telos? Aristotle thought so. He thought the telos of human life is happiness, a point disputed by other philosophers throughout human history. St. Augustine, 7 centuries later, thought the telos of life is to love God. To a 20th-century existentialist like Martin Heidegger, man's telos is to live without denial of the true human condition, particularly death. Happiness? How shallow! Meaning of life jokes have multiplied as fast as meanings of life, which in turn have multiplied as fast as philosophers. A seeker has heard that the wisest guru in all of India lives atop India's highest mountain. So the seeker treks over hill and Delhi until he reaches the fabled mountain. It's incredibly steep, and more than once he slips and falls. By the time he reaches the top, he is full of cuts and bruises, but there is the guru sitting cross-legged in front of his cave. "Oh, wise guru," the seeker says, "I have come to you to ask what the secret of life is." "Ah, yes, the secret of life," the guru says. "The secret of life is a teacup." "A teacup? I came all the way up here to find the meaning of life, and you tell me it's a teacup?" The guru shrugs. "So maybe it isn't a teacup." This guru is acknowledging that formulating the telos of life is a slippery business. Furthermore, it's not everybody's cup of tea. There is a distinction between the telos of life, what human beings are meant to be, and a particular individual's goals in life, what he wants to be. Is Sam, the dentist in the following story, really seeking the universal telos of life, or simply doing his own thing? His mom clearly has her own idea of the telos of her son's life. A Philadelphia dentist, Sam Lipschitz, went off to India to find the meaning of life. Months went by, and his mother didn't hear a word from him. Finally, she took a plane to India and asked for the wisest man there. She was directed to an ashram, where the guard told her that she would have to wait a week for an audience with the guru, and at that time she would only be allowed to speak 3 words to him. She waited, carefully preparing her words. When she was finally ushered in to see the guru, she said to him, "Sam, come home." Look up metaphysics in the dictionary, and it tells you the word stems from the title of a treatise by Aristotle, and that it deals with questions at a level of abstraction beyond meta, scientific observation. But this turns out to be a case of what is known in Latin as post hoc hocum. In fact, Aristotle didn't call his treatise metaphysics at all, let alone because it dealt with questions beyond the purview of science. Actually, it was given that name in the 1st century AD by an editor of Aristotle's collected works, who chose the title because that chapter was beyond, i.e. came after, Aristotle's treatise on physics. Since time immemorial, time has been questioned. Let's learn more about it in our next sections. Infinity and eternity. It turns out that, however wonderful this world is or isn't, we're only here for a short visit. But short compared to what? An unlimited number of years? Being a rationalist, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz wasn't content to say that anything just happened, as though something else might just as easily have happened instead. He felt that there must be some reason that made every situation necessary. Why does it rain more in Seattle than in Albuquerque? Because conditions A, B, and C make it impossible for it to be the other way around. Given conditions A, B, and C, it couldn't be any other way. So far, most of us would agree with him, especially those of us who live in Seattle. But Leibniz goes on to argue that even those antecedent conditions, A, B, and C, could not have been otherwise. And the ones before them, and before them, and so on, and so on, and scooby-dooby-doo. This is what he called the principle of sufficient reason, meaning that the reason any actual state of affairs is actual is that it would be impossible for it to be otherwise. A universe that did not have a disproportionate amount of rain in Seattle and all the conditions that lead to that rain just wouldn't cut it as a universe. It would be chaos. The universe would have no uni. The notion of infinity has been confounding metaphysicians for, well, an eternity. Non-metaphysicians, however, have been less impressed. Two cows are standing in the pasture. One turns to the other and says, "Although pi is usually abbreviated to 5 numbers, it actually goes on into infinity." The second cow turns to the first and says, "Moo." The following joke combines the idea of eternity with another howler of a philosophical concept, relativity. A woman is told by her doctor that she has 6 months to live. "Is there anything I can do?" she asks. "Yes, there is," the doctor replies. "You could marry a tax accountant." "How will that help with my illness?" the woman asks. "Oh, it won't help your illness," says the doctor, "but it will make that 6 months seem like an eternity." This joke raises the philosophical question, how could something finite, like 6 months, possibly be analogous to something infinite, like eternity? Those who ask this question have never lived with a tax accountant. Wow, just how do these guys know all this stuff? The next sections may help answer that. Epistemology, the theory of knowledge. How do you know that you know the stuff you think you know? Take away the option of answering, "I just do," and what's left is epistemology. Dimitri, "I'm feeling good now, Tasso. I've got logic down cold, so the rest should be a picnic in the Acropolis." Tasso, "What Acropolis?" Dimitri, "That one, right over there. Maybe you ought to ease off on the ouzo, pal." Tasso, "But is that the Acropolis, or just something that you believe is the Acropolis? How do you know it's real? For that matter, how do you know anything is real?" Dimitri, "Next round's on me." Pragmatism. For an epistemological pragmatist, like the late 19th century American philosopher William James, the truth of a statement lies in its practical consequences. According to James, we choose our truth by what difference it will make in practice. We say Newton's law of gravity is true, not because it corresponds to the way things really are, but because it has proven useful in predicting the behavior of two objects relative to each other under many different sorts of circumstances. Hey, I bet apples would fall down even in New Jersey. The day a theory stops being useful is the day we will replace it with some other one. A woman reports her husband's disappearance to the police. They ask her for a description, and she says, "He's 6'3" tall, well built, with thick, curly hair." Her friend says, "What are you talking about? Your husband is 5'4", bald, and has a huge belly." And she says, "Who wants that one back?" This much of the story is well known. You may have heard it yourself. What is not so well known is the dialogue that followed. The police say, Lady, we are asking you for a description of your husband that corresponds to your actual husband. The woman responds, Correspondence, schmorespondence. Truth cannot be determined solely by epistemological criteria, because the adequacy of those criteria cannot be determined apart from the goals sought and values held. That is to say, in the end, truth is what satisfies, and God knows my husband didn't do that. Wow, there sure are an awful lot of words to identify and explain all of these philosophical theories, including theories about the words themselves, as described in the next sections. Philosophy of Language. When former President William Jefferson Clinton responded to a query, "It depends on what your definition of is is," he was doing language philosophy. He may have also been doing other things. Dimitri, I'm finally beginning to see through you, Tasso. This whole philosophy business is just playing games with words. Tasso, exactly. Now we're getting somewhere. Dimitri, so you admit it. Philosophy is just semantics. Tasso, just semantics? How else could you do philosophy? With grunts and giggles? Ordinary Language Philosophy. Ludwig Wittgenstein and his followers at Oxford University in the mid-20th century claimed that the classical philosophical questions, free will, the existence of God, and so forth, were puzzling only because they were posed in confused and confusing language. Their job as philosophers was to untangle linguistic knots, reframe questions, and do the next best thing to resolving the puzzles, make them go away. For example, Descartes, back in the 17th century, had declared that people are composed of a mind and a body, with the mind being like a ghost in a machine. Philosophers then puzzled for centuries over what sort of thing this ghost is. Wittgenstein's Oxford disciple Gilbert Ryle said, in effect, "Wrong question! It's not any sort of thing, because it isn't a thing at all. If we just look at the way we actually speak about so-called mental events, we can see that our words are really just a shorthand for describing behavior. Nothing whatever is lost if we simply throw away the word for the place behavior supposedly comes from. Consider it disposed of, Gilly." The young couple in the following story clearly needs to reframe their question. A young married couple moves into a new apartment and decides to repaper the dining room. They call on a neighbor who has a dining room the same size and ask, "How many rolls of wallpaper did you buy when you papered your dining room?" "7," he says. So the couple buys 7 rolls of expensive paper and they start papering. When they get to the end of the 4th roll, the dining room is finished. Annoyed, they go back to the neighbor and say, "We followed your advice, but we ended up with 3 extra rolls." "So," he says, "that happened to you too." Oops. As the poet Gertrude Stein lay on her deathbed, her partner, Alice B. Toklas, leaned over and whispered, "What is the answer, Gertrude?" Replied Stein, "What's the question?" So, is it just me, or is all of this talk about philosophy causing you to get a little fuzzy-headed too? Interestingly enough, there's a theory for that. We'll round out the theories today with philosophical ideas that are clear as mud. The philosophy of fuzziness. One contemporary technical linguistic concept goes by the deceptively banal name of vagueness. Vagueness is a term used by philosophers called fuzzy logicians, honest to God, to describe the quality of having a truth value of 1 to 10, rather than being simply and absolutely true or false. "That man is bald," for example, might be used to refer to anyone from Michael Jordan to Matt Lauer. From Matt's point of view, the term is way too vague. Some philosophers have seen vagueness as a pervasive defect of natural languages, say Swedish or Swahili, and have advocated the construction of an artificial language, like mathematics, to eliminate vagueness. In the following story, the guard is trying to mix a vague natural language and a precise mathematical language with predictable results. Some tourists at the Museum of Natural History are marveling at the dinosaur bones. One of them asks the guard, "Can you tell me how old these bones are?" The guard replies, "They're 3 million, 4 years, and 6 months old." "That's an awfully exact number," says the tourist. "How do you know their age so precisely?" The guard answers, "Well, the dinosaur bones were 3 million years old when I started working here, and that was 4.5 years ago." Vagueness rules. True story. Guy Goma was sitting in a reception room at the BBC, waiting for a job interview for the position of data support person, when a television producer entered the room and asked, "Are you Guy Cuny?" Mr. Goma, who is from the Congo and is a newcomer to the English language, replied, "Yes." The producer whisked him into a studio where the host of a live TV news program was expecting to interview a business expert on the trademark dispute between Apple Computer and Apple Core Recording Company. "Were you surprised by the verdict today?" asked the interviewer. After a moment of sheer panic, Mr. Goma decided to give it his best shot. "I'm very surprised to see this verdict, because I was not expecting that," he answered. "A big surprise," said his host. "Exactly," replied Mr. Goma. The interviewer asked if the verdict would allow more people to download music, and Mr. Goma allowed as how more and more people would be downloading music in the future. The interviewer concurred. "Thanks very much indeed," he exclaimed. Dimitri, this clarifies everything we've been talking about. Tasso, in what way? Dimitri, what you call philosophy, I call a joke. We've run out of time for today's episode of That's Halath. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's Halath is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Are you enjoying the show? Do you have any humorous quotes or authors you'd like to share? We'd love to hear from you. If you have any comments or questions about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number one more time is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.